I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Each generation called on to fight a war reveals something of its nature on the battlefield. The way that nature is observed and reported goes to shape the generation's myths. The Greatest Generation, with its little guy heroism, as recorded by Ernie Pyle, stands in stark contrast to the bad craziness of soldiers losing their innocence in Vietnam, as memorialized by Michael Herrer. The generation that fought the war to overthrow Saddam is different still. That's the view of reporter Evan Wright, who covered the war for Rolling Stone while embedded with a group of recon Marines, the Corps Special Forces. Wright notes the difference this way. These young men entered Iraq imbued with the sense that the big lie is as central to American governance as taxation. They learned of the significance of the presidency not through an inspiring speech at the Berlin Wall, but through a national obsession with semen stains connected to a White House sex scandal. Though sex scandal isn't the word Evan uses. Evan Wright coined a name for these young men. He calls them Generation Kill, and that is the title of his new book. We're talking in this hour with author Evan Wright and with one of the soldiers he wrote about. Connection listeners, would it be naive to think that today's soldiers fighting in Iraq are any different from soldiers of previous wars? Or are there important differences in culture and mindset, upbringing and worldview? And how do you think those differences have shaped and are shaping events in Iraq? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call to join in the conversation. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm joined from the NPR studios in New York by the author Evan Wright. And I'm also joined from NPR in Washington by Captain Nathaniel Fick, who was one of the 23 recon Marines that Evan profiled, first for Rolling Stone and then in his new book, Generation Kill. Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Good morning, Michael. Okay.
Evan, let me turn to you first. Just some backstory on this. Remind us again of how the embed program worked and how you got hooked up with the group of Marines that you ultimately traveled through Iraq with.
Well, it was sort of a lottery that was done through your news organization, and technically we didn't have a lot of say in where we went. I had been embedded before with an element of the 101st Airborne Division in Afghanistan, and this time around I wanted to do something different. So when we were all waiting for the war to start in the Middle East, I began lobbying the Pentagon and told them I would travel light. I wouldn't be carrying a sat phone and a lot of gear, and I can go anywhere. So they put me with First Recon.
So it was a lottery, but open to lobbying.
Exactly.
Right. And Nathaniel Fick, when you heard you were going to have this journalist accompanying you, I won't say dumped on you, what was your first thought?
I think dumped on me is pretty accurate, Michael. I was adamantly opposed at first. I saw Evan as another mouth to feed and someone I didn't know. Someone who may not be able to take care of himself. So I went into it with serious reservations.
Were your feelings kind of mirrored? But you were a lieutenant during the war. I mean, the fellows who shared your rank and had to deal with these reporters, did they share your view of the embed program?
Generally, I would say yes. And in time, Evan quickly won us over, and my view changed.
But did he win you over before the war or only after combat started? How much time, actually, the real question is, how much time did you have to get to know each other before, you know, going into combat?
Can I jump in here?
Yeah, of course. Don't wait to be called
on. I just wanted to say that I met them about a week and a half before the invasion started. And they, whatever negative feelings higher-ups might have had about having a reporter, they didn't reveal them to me. The men in the platoon did give me a slightly hard time when I first met them. When I went, Lieutenant Fick, I basically met him at near a chow hall, and we talked, and I was very impressed by him. And he suggested I meet his platoon. He said, they're a big bunch of characters. You're going to really like them. And he pushed me into the tent, and the first night I slept there, they put me in a walkway that the men were using to access the latrines, and they were stepping over me all night. And it was kind of miserable. But from there, we sort of grew on each other.
But you knew you were going to get hazed, man.
Yeah, I did. And they look at reporters as, I mean, I can't use the words that they would use to describe us, but they view reporters as a bunch of wimps. And they think we're all communists. I mean, that's like the, you know, sort of thumbnail view that they have of us. And Go ahead.
No, carry on. No, the problem, listeners, is Evan, who you've just been listening to, is in New York, and Nathaniel Fick, who we're going to hear from in a second, is in Washington, and I'm here in Boston. So we can't make that significant eye contact that means I'll stop talking now so my colleague can have a turn. So you carry on and finish your thought, Evan, and Nathaniel, jump in when you feel like it.
Well, I was going to say that the thing that won them over is I originally, years ago, had written for Hustler magazine, and as soon as I told them this, they changed completely. If I had said, hey, I write for the New York Times, I don't think they would have been impressed. But as soon as I mentioned that magazine, they all wanted to talk to me. They wanted to know what my job had been like there. And they really didn't care. You know, the nature of being them in this situation is they don't really want to talk about war. In their free time, they want to talk about things back home. And obviously, Hustler magazine was of interest to them.
And Nathaniel, when you first met Evan, were you concerned about his physical abilities? To be a recon Marine, you have to go through the kinds of training that, you know, that Delta Force goes through, that Green Berets go through. And, you know, even a reasonably fit reporter just can't match up to that.
That's right. I was concerned. It's a platoon of 23 men, all of whom are independent operators. And I had faith that each of them, if something happened, could survive on his own. And the prerequisite for being a productive member of the team to helping everyone else is first helping yourself. And I didn't have confidence that Evan would be able to do that.
Evan, were you concerned?
Well, you know, ignorance is bliss. And for instance, when they finally put me with one of their teams, they put me in the one Humvee that had a little bit of armor plating on it, which I thought was really nice of them. Only later on did I realize that that Humvee had a little bit of armor on it because it goes on point. It's the front Humvee to roll into an ambush or hostile area. So I was concerned, but as a reporter, you know, the more action, the better. And ironically, if you start getting shot at as a journalist, it's kind of a good thing.
Which we did intensely.
Yeah, I know. We're going to talk about what happened when the war started. But first, just to clarify again, these Marines, I mean, Marines have their own special myth, but these guys have a myth within the Marines. Nathaniel, describe some of the training that you have to go through to become a recon Marine.
Most of the recon Marines come out of the Marine infantry. They've done one or two deployments as infantrymen in Marine battalions. And then it operates sort of on a tap system. Many people get called into the unit by people they know who are already there. Others are able to attend a screening and go through a grueling swim and run test just to receive a slot to try formally. They go through a course in Coronado, California called the Basic Reconnaissance Course, which is 3 months of recon training. And that's usually followed with airborne training, parachuting at Fort Benning, Georgia, scuba training in Florida, and a course called SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, how to evade capture and resist torture as a POW.
And in learning how to resist torture, they're effectively tortured.
They are. I spent an uncomfortable night in a small concrete cell being doused in water.
Say that again?
I spent an uncomfortable night in a small concrete cell being doused in water.
Were you... Evan?
I also understand that Gunny Wynn, the Gunnery Sergeant Wynn, the platoon sergeant, had gone through SEERS. They made him wear a hood and pull around an African-American Marine who was a fellow inmate in this sort of mock POW camp. They made him pull the African-American around on a leash as a sort of way to humiliate each other and create dissension among the ranks. That's the sort of psychological warfare they practice on them.
And when you wrote the book, did you know that the image of being hooded and abused and then dragging a fellow prisoner around as if he were a dog, did you know it was going to have the resonance that it has now since Abu Ghraib?
No, of course I did not. And I actually think they're unrelated because I don't think anybody that has been brought up in the Abu Ghraib scandal went through, none of those reservists at least, none of the enlisted reservists went through the SEER program. So I think it's a completely different matter.
All right. So you arrived. You guys hooked up, assessed each other. Lieutenant Fick was deeply skeptical. You earned your spurs by sleeping in the walkway to the urinal the first night you were with the fellas. And then the war started. What happened?
Well, I still had to do some horse trading with the battalion commander. He didn't want me riding in the lead Humvee. And so I had to turn in all of my equipment, my sat phone, and any means of contacting the outside world. Essentially, they didn't want me to give away where they were going. So the war started, and I was in the lead Humvee and after that horse trading. And as a result of that, I essentially never really saw any other reporters or civilians or even high-level officers for a long period of time, nor to even tell my editors where I was going.
Now, I started the segment, Evan, by reading something you wrote early in the book, which really framed the whole book for me, which is this notion that the guys you were with were fundamentally different, say, than soldiers would have been who fought in Vietnam, and I'll just extrapolate from that, from World War II, and that you see them, I think, as being either super clued up or just super cynical. I'm not sure which. Lieutenant Fick, do you agree with that point of view, that they are fundamentally different kinds of warriors than those who fought previously in modern American wars?
I'm not sure I do. I think those differences maybe exist outside a firefight, but as soon as the bullets start flying, I think people fall back on some fundamental human concepts. And in that way, I would argue that warfare hasn't changed much since ancient Greece. The raw material is the same.
Well, Evan, and I'd like to, the thing with the title, getting back to how are they different, part of it is not just them, it's how society perceives them. And one of the things I think leading up to this war is a lot of reporters continued to view this war through the lens of Vietnam. And Vietnam was all about this loss of innocence where people suddenly woke up to bad things that their government was doing. And in this war, I don't think these guys were so innocent about their government. This is not to say they weren't patriotic and they didn't believe in the war, but I think they are less innocent. And the other thing is that leading up to this war, the reason I picked the title, which Lieutenant Fick, by the way, never liked, but the reason I picked the title, Generation Kill, it was a rebuttal to the lore of the greatest generation that we've built up in the past, especially in the past decade in this country, where in trying to rightfully honor people who fought in World War II, I think we began to romanticize warfare, and we began to think of warfare almost as like a Hallmark card. We remembered World War II as the image of the sailor returning home and kissing his fiance, and we forgot about the horrors of war. So part of what I was trying to do with this book and the title of it was to say, let's forget about that past and how we viewed both World War II and Vietnam, and this is now a new generation, and this is their war. And what I emerged from that experience with was, well, it's a really terrible thing, and they kill a lot of people. And in a sense, that's a big cliche about war, but I think that our society had forgotten some of those lessons from our past wars.
We're talking in this hour, Connection listeners, with author Evan Wright. His new book is called Generation Kill, and it's based on his experiences traveling with a platoon of recon Marines during the war to overthrow Saddam, major combat operations in March, April 2003. What do you think is different about today's warriors compared to warriors from 30 years ago, 50 years ago? Call us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour with author Evan Wright about his new book, Generation Kill, recounting his experiences during major combat operations in the war in Iraq last year. He traveled with a group of 23 recon Marines. Connection listeners, do you think that today's soldiers fighting in Iraq are different from soldiers of previous wars? Do you think that all war turns soldiers into much the same kind of person? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. And also taking part in the conversation is Nathaniel Fick. Captain Nathaniel Fick, I apologize, Nathaniel, for referring to you as lieutenant. You mustered out of the Army with the rank of captain. How did you get into the Marines? Was this a family tradition, or how did you get there?
It was not. During college, I had every intention of going to medical school, and ended up doing about a 180-degree turn during my junior year. I actually went to a talk by Tom Ricks, who was then the Wall Street Journal's Pentagon correspondent. And during the question and answer session following his talk, he fielded a hostile question about the presence of ROTC on the Dartmouth campus. And his questioner was saying that ROTC had no place on an elite college campus because it would stifle thought and militarize the campus. And Mr. Rick's argument was, no, you're wrong. The presence of ROTC will liberalize the military, and that's a good thing for all of us. And his argument resonated with me.
So you entered the military in the hopes of being a liberalizing force?
Well, I'm not sure I had an agenda. I entered the military.
And you chose the Marines?
I chose the Marines because the Marines were the toughest. I figured if I was going to do it, I wanted to be with the best. And I'm glad I did.
And you were tapped and became a recon officer?
I did. I did a tour in the infantry, like most recon Marines do. I served in Afghanistan immediately after 9/11. And following that deployment, was invited to try out for recon.
And everything that you trained for in recon, how much of that was of use when you first rolled out of Kuwait, over the berms, and into the southern Iraq with its congealed nest of dried out marshland and small mud hut villages?
Well, when you fall back on the fundamentals, it comes down to shoot, move, and communicate. And we did shoot, we did move, and we did communicate. I would say the similarity ended there. Recon teams trained to do stealthy, covert missions, usually led by sergeants, five- or six-man teams. And instead, we found ourselves working all together as a platoon, company, battalion, riding around in Humvees in the daylight, advertising our presence and shooting it up.
Evan, in the book, you write about first combat experience, and we've got that reading selected. I'm wondering if you could just read a bit from the book about that, and then we can talk some more about it.
Okay, great. This is a passage about being in a mortar attack. It's actually referring to a mission on April 9th. Outside of Baquba, and it was actually technically this was happening after Saddam had fled or the regime had fallen. And so it starts, "Before leaving on this mission, many of the men in Colbert's platoon had said goodbye to one another by shaking hands or even by hugging. The formal farewells seemed odd considering that everyone was going to be shoulder to shoulder in the cramped Humvees. The goodbyes almost seemed an acknowledgement of the transformations that take place in combat. Friends who had lolled around together during free time, talking about bands, stupid Marine Corps rules, and girlfriends' fine asses, aren't really the same people anymore once they've entered the battlefield. In combat, the change seems physical at first. Adrenaline begins to flood your system the moment the first bullet is fired. But unlike adrenaline rushes in the civilian world, a car accident or bungee jump, where the surge lasts only a few minutes, in combat, the rush can go on for hours. In time, your body seems to burn out from it, or maybe the adrenaline just runs out. Whatever the case, after a while, you begin to almost lose the physical capacity for fear. Explosions go off. You cease to jump or flinch. In this moment now, everyone sits still, numbly watching the mortars thump down nearby. The only things moving are the pupils of their eyes. This is not to say that the terror goes away. It simply moves out from the twitching muscles and nerves in your body and takes up residence in your mind. If you feed it with morbid thoughts of all the terrible ways you could be maimed or die, it gets worse. It also gets worse if you think about pleasant things. Good memories or plans for the future just remind you how much you don't want to die or get hurt. It's best to shut down, to block everything out. But to reach that state, you almost have to give up being yourself. This is why, I believe, everyone said goodbye to each other yesterday before leaving on this mission. They would still be together, but they wouldn't really be seeing one another for a while, since each man would, in his own way, be sort of gone."
That's a very, very insightful passage about, and this is based
that's
on...
That's an insight gleaned through getting shot at and bombed, by the way.
Right. Well, and if this was April 9th, you've been being shot at and bombed for almost 3 weeks at that point.
Yeah.
And you do learn something. But I wonder, did you talk to the guys afterwards about this insight the next time there was downtime? I mean, maybe when you got from Bakuba to Baghdad and you were staked out, I think, in some abandoned factory. I mean, did you ever discuss these insights with the fellows?
Well, you know, I hate to say it, but no. We often, I mean, I, you know, talked a lot with them, but after combat, people try not to talk about it, I found. The other thing is that in the past, earlier on, someone mentioned, you know, why people fight, and Lieutenant Fix said, or Captain Fix said, it was for, you know, the old reasons in war. But one of the things that I found remarkable about being with these guys was that in a combat situation, yeah, people fight because they don't want to die and they want to protect their, you know, their brother warriors. But the other thing that was often operating was guys did not want to look like they were wimps. And there's a big macho factor in combat that I think comes out. One of the members of the platoon, Corporal Anthony Jacks, also known as Manimal, once said, you know, I'm not afraid of losing face in Iraq. I want to see how much face I can get. And this was a big factor in you know, how they performed and how well they behaved. It was, you know, old-fashioned macho.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Travis is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts.
Hi. I just had a couple comments. First to Captain Sick. I just really appreciate what you do. I'm enlisting the Army myself, and my dream is to become a member of the Army Special Forces. And the comment is just that you know, I really think what you guys do is some of the most important stuff in the world, and it bothers me. I mean, where I'm from, you know, the Northeast, and I was just reading in the paper, California, some high schools banned recruiters. It just seems to me that, you know, people say, oh, we support the troops and everything, but there's this aversion to even saying, you know, what these guys do need to be done. And, you know, I don't think killing's right or anything, but I think it needs to be done. And I read in the paper, you know, Special Forces get kills in Afghanistan, and no one wants to say, you know, that's horrible, but it needs to be done. And it just bothers me there's a lack of appreciation in, for the military as a whole and Special Forces community in particular. And I just wanted to say that I really admire you guys and what you do.
Travis, are you going into the military?
Yes, I am.
When?
After the summer. I just graduated from high school. I'll be enlisted in the Army after the summer. So, but I've always, I mean, like I said, it's amazing to me that so few people know about the Special Forces community to begin with. And fewer still appreciate it.
Travis, stay right there. I'm going to ask Nathaniel Fick to give you some advice about the military.
Thanks, Travis. Good luck with Special Forces. I think that the military, in a strange way, likes to be under the radar. And almost take some pride in being underappreciated, as odd as that sounds. My advice to you would be to ensure that you have your motivation right. You know, it's mom and apple pie or the paycheck might not be enough to sustain you. You're ultimately going to have to rely on the people on your left and right. And I just hope you are able to build good relationships with the people you're with and trust them and believe in them.
Evan, what do you say to Travis?
Well, one of the things about Travis's comment was about killing, and of course the title Generation Kill of my book, it has another meaning to it, which is, although Lieutenant Fick never liked the title, it was after a firefight in which the Marines had been attacked, and they shot back very well, and they destroyed large portions of this town in so doing, without knowingly killing civilians in that engagement. But after that engagement, Lieutenant Fick said, these guys have no problem with killing. And he was reporting on, he cited some old figures where in past wars, Marines did not fire their guns as easily as they have in this conflict. Every guy, nobody flinched, nobody hesitated to return fire. And a lot of the guys would compare, or some of the guys compared being in combat to playing video games. And it seemed very easy. But on the other hand, the other part of this book is I think all of them who participated in this war, they did pay a price. And that price comes from often, you know, they killed people and it was sometimes very hard to tell whether they had killed the right people. They always did their best. And sometimes they definitely, in many instances, they definitely killed civilians. And they don't take that lightly. At all. And that's a big part of the book. One of the Marines at the end of it, Sergeant Aspera, I quote him saying, you know, the American people ought to know the price we pay for them. And I think that price is I don't think they shrink from getting shot at, from the action, the combat. I think they actually like that. But I think they really don't like the killing.
Evan, I'm just going to stop there and ask Travis. Now you were talking about the price beforehand. Right. Did you hear what Nathaniel Fick said about, in the end, it comes down to who's on the left of you and who's on the right of you?
That's a common theme I hear all the time. That's what the ex-military I talk to, you know, tell me that, you know, don't listen to everyone else. But, I mean, just going back to briefly what I said before, you know, I understand that the military needs to stay under the radar and that's how they want it, but it just bothers me. I mean, I live in the Northeast, and I've talked to hundreds of people about my decision, and the only two people who ever said, you know what, you're making a good choice and we support you and you should be proud of yourself, are the boss I work for in my printing company. So it just seems that it's so regionalized, you know, the kind of support. But if I could just throw a last question in there, if I may, please.
Quickly, Travis.
Captain Spick, I was just wondering, do you have any advice for making it through the Special Forces training? That's okay. What I want to know.
All right, take that answer from off the air. I'm going to throw that to Nathaniel Fick. And Travis, the best of luck to you when you do go into the Army. Thanks for your call. Any quick advice for Travis on getting through that Special Forces training?
Gut check, Travis. It's a long, hard road, and it only gets harder.
Okay. Let's move on. One of the interesting impressions in the book, aside from the fact that the platoon you were with is maybe the most profane collection of guys I've ever read about, for real, yeah, as opposed to, you know, fictional imaginations, is the fact that though you were trained for this very highly specialized kind of combat, in the end, basically, your mission constantly seemed to be, you were like, you know, putting the helmet on top of a bayonet and sticking it out of a foxhole to see how much fire you could draw.
Right.
Did you have a lot of trouble dealing with the various different rules of engagement as you worked your way through Iraq?
I did, Travis. I'm sorry.
It's
did, Michael. And you know, I reached a realization early on, and I think Evan and I actually had a conversation about this, and he kind of helped me shift my attitude. I had been a little bit embittered about how I felt like we were being used, and then I realized that the job of any unit is to provide options to its higher commander. So I would get frustrated when my Marines would tell me why they couldn't do something or why they shouldn't do something. And the same is true of the commanders above us. They did not want to hear why we couldn't do something. Our job was to provide options. And in the end, I think that's what First Recon did, and they did it well, even though we had some bumps along the road.
You are listening to The Connection from NPR. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Brett is calling from Eden, North Carolina.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My observation, I'm a middle school teacher down here, and I spent 8 years in the Navy during the 1980s working in intelligence analysis. This whole conflict that's going on right now and the nature of the military right now has really changed a lot since back when I was in the Navy. Earlier, one of your speakers mentioned a macho factor that we see right now. And I see that in the middle schools, actually. There seems to sort of be a convergence of contributing factors right now with the young people that are coming of age and going into the service. For one thing, it's very expensive to go to college. And there's been quite a breakdown of the family in terms of the biological parents staying together these days. And so the kids are left without many educational options. Plus, they don't seem to have a lot of male role models in their lives. And plus, the generation we're looking at in the military right now is the first one that's really always had a computer mouse in their hand. And there's a certain point-and-click instantaneous gratification thing that I don't remember growing up around when I was young.
Let me put that point to Evan, Brett, because this, is, I think, is right on his grand theory of the kind of guys he was in combat with.
Yeah, well, he hit a lot of points there. I mean, first of all, you know, we are in an era where probably most kids, or at least half of kids today, come from broken homes. And the Marine Corps, or any branch of the military, can become this father figure to people that are in search of that. But I also think that guys join the Marines, and women too, but in these units it's all guys, because there's this great hunger in our society for some sort of authentic experience. I mean, everything that kids do when they're growing up is always co-opted by marketing. You know, it's turned into a Mountain Dew commercial. And so by joining the Marines, they can have this authentic kind of macho experience. And of course, warfare then, you know, heightens it even more.
Did any of them have that, Lord, this is not a game moment, where they realized that this heightened experience really was something that could get them killed?
You know, it's a funny question, because even my own reactions, that very seldom did people have that. I mean, even in the midst of the early firefights, guys afterwards were saying, wow, that was just like a movie. And I noticed myself when we were under fire, I kept comparing, oh, this is like Black Hawk Down. And I think, you know, movies and video games are so instilled in our minds that even reality has a tough time competing with it. But, you know, people did have real fear. I don't want to underplay that.
Now, let me just ask Nathaniel, when you'd obviously served in Afghanistan, but the first few times that you were in real firefights, did you have a sense that, gee, this isn't as real as it's cranked up to be, and immediately pigeonhole it into something you saw before, like Black Hawk Down, for example?
Definitely. You paint it in the frame of reference that you're accustomed to. So, yeah, you say this is like a movie or this is like a video game. And it doesn't seem real. You see the muzzle flashes, you hear the explosions, but you don't even think, or at least I didn't think, that I would ever get hit. The fear is in anticipation and then maybe in hindsight, but not in the moment. In the moment, it's almost like a game.
Connection listeners, we're talking in this hour about Evan Wright's new book, Generation Kill. We're talking with the author and with Nathaniel Fick, who was the officer in charge of the platoon that Wright traveled through Iraq with last year during major combat operations. It's a new world out there of combat. Different. You go in with one expectation, the reality is always different. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. We've got some calls lined up, and we're coming to you just after the break. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour about the new book, Generation Kill, based on the experiences of reporter Evan Wright, who was embedded during major combat operations with a recon Marine unit as it worked its way to Baghdad. This is a special forces unit trained in a certain kind of combat, but of course in Iraq, that kind of combat they didn't have. Instead, they were working their way through villages and towns where civilians and combatants looked one in the same. Mistakes happened. I'm going to ask you, Evan, to read that second reading that we selected.
Sure.
And I just want to advise listeners that this is a very graphic description of a real event, and some of you may find the language upsetting. Go ahead, Evan.
Sure. Up the road from where we are laughing, the men in Charlie Company watch as two men run from a car the Marines have just riddled with dozens of rounds. It's a four-door sedan. Doors are open. Lights are on despite the heavy weapons fire it took from a platoon of Marines. It's a miracle that these two men, including the driver, have stepped out alive. The Marines hold their fire as the men, dressed in robes, throw their hands up. They are unarmed. As Marines shout at them, they drop obediently to the side of the road. Sergeant Graves, whose team beautifully destroyed the building that shielded the enemy gunmen during the assault through Al Hay, approaches the car with another Marine. Graves sees a little girl curled up in the back seat. She looks to be about 3, the same age as his daughter, at home in California. There's a small amount of blood on the upholstery, but the girl's eyes are open. She seems to be cowering. Graves reaches in to pick her up, thinking about what medical supplies he might need to treat her, he later says, when the top of her head slides off and her brains fall out. When Graves steps back, he nearly falls over when his boot slips in the girl's brains. It takes a full minute before Graves can actually talk. The situation is one he can only describe in elemental terms. I could see her throat from the top of her skull, he says. No weapons are found in the car. Mish, the translator, asks the father, sitting by the side of the road, why he didn't heed the warning shots and stop. The father simply repeats, in Arabic, I'm sorry, then meekly asks permission to pick up his daughter's body. The last the Marines see of him, he is walking down the road, carrying her corpse in his arms. And that's a passage about an occurrence that was fairly common at marine roadblocks. I could expand on that if you'd like.
Okay, because this is about rules of engagement in any case, which
yes.
never seem to stay the same from day to day. Go ahead, Evan.
Well, the basic situation was that this was the front unit. They were ahead of all other Marine forces in Iraq, so they were setting up on these roads where people perhaps didn't expect to see Americans. And the Marines have, you know, one of their most important jobs is force protection. They have to protect themselves. They set up these roadblocks often with barbed wire, concertina wire, and when cars approached, they would fire warning shots over the top of the car. But what seemed to happen is civilians were confused by this, and when cars got too close, the Marines then were under orders to, you know, shoot the occupants and stop the car physically with, you know, machine gun fire or whatever. And so, you know, civilians were killed. The thing about this situation is an interesting one because the enlisted guys who were actually pulling the triggers, they wanted to soften up the rules of engagement a little bit by firing smoke grenades, which they thought maybe drivers of cars could understand better than just warning shots. And what was interesting is the officers really didn't want to do this at first, and they had a valid argument too, which is Marines have to be an aggressive force. They have to protect themselves above all. And it's one of these interesting things that I felt, you know, as a reporter, it was sort of a privilege to be able to look inside this military unit and see what was going on, because basically, and I think Lieutenant Fick might want to add, or Captain Fick might want to add something of his own on this, but the men ultimately wanted to be less aggressive here. And people like Captain Fick wanted the men to continue to be aggressive at these roadblocks because Fick, you know, his interest was to protect his men. And the men actually were less interested in protecting themselves than in preventing more civilian casualties.
Nathaniel?
Heartbreaking decisions. When shooting a car whose occupants you're unsure of is the best option, you're in a bad place. And I did see the tension between the guys pulling the triggers and the guys giving the orders. And it's almost hard to articulate now sitting here and try to make sense of it. But I did not want to spend a month after coming home from Iraq, traveling around the country to funerals and telling the families of my Marines why they died working for me. And trying to calculate relative values of human life is futile. But that's really what the decisions come down to.
Yeah, what's interesting in reading through the book is that the members of the squads, very colorful figures that you focus in on, Evan, is that they tend to get super excited when they're for sure involved in guys they are confident are the enemy. Then there's this other side of it. So there has to be an awareness within all of this that you separate out, except in the reality, often at night, you can't actually make the quick decision on who is whom.
Well, these guys, if you had more to add, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, these guys want to be heroes. I mean, I think Americans are blessed or cursed with a hero complex, and they want to go in and save people and, you know, go, you know, like cowboys, get the bad guys and ride off in the sunset. And they're devastated when they don't. And one of the things I wanted to add to this is everybody is talking, you know, about the Abu Ghraib situation. And in this unit, the interesting thing within the battalion is that, unfortunately, what's happened as a result of Abu Ghraib is it's portrayed all of the soldiers over there as sort of like, you know, sociopathic losers. And in this unit, the enlisted men were often trying to stand up and make good moral decisions. And in the one instance of where there was abuse of a prisoner, it was actually an officer who was involved in it. And it was his men who were standing up to him and trying to get him to stop this behavior. He was taunting a bound prisoner with a bayonet, and in another instance he tried to bayonet one in a more ambiguous situation. So these guys want to do the right thing. I mean, most of them, that's why they're there. So they have the macho side and they want to be warriors, but they don't want to be doing this. They don't want to be hurting civilians.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. David is calling from Nashville, Tennessee.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on your earlier question that you posed to the listeners about the is the soldier of today the same as it was, say, in previous wars? And I would comment that in previous wars we had a much more defined role of, for a lack of a better way to say it, evil and good. There's no question that Nazi Germany and Japan needed to be stopped, and unfortunately military action was the only way to do it. As we move later in the chronology, with each successive war, the line becomes fuzzier about what's evil and what's good. And I know, you know, in many parts of the world, we're viewed just as evil as the people we are trying to liberate from an evil. And I would ask your callers to comment on how that affects the soldier who is much more informed than, say, the guy who came out of the cornfield out of the Depression in 1930 and blindly signed up after Pearl Harbor.
Okay, David, I'm going to put that question first to Nathaniel Fick. Do you feel the historical difference as David poses it?
I have two conflicting views on this, so forgive me if I contradict myself. Having served in Afghanistan and Iraq, I saw a palpable difference in people's attitudes between Afghanistan and Iraq, and in a way I think it mirrored the different attitudes in the country. Afghanistan was very clear-cut. It was, in pure terms, it was revenge. And we carried cards with us on missions, and they had a photo on them of firefighters raising the flag at the World Trade Center, and they said, "Freedom endures." And we left them as a calling card in houses that we raided. And in Iraq, I found that the attitude was more one of professional obligation. We're here because we are volunteers in a professional military and we're doing our job. The flip side of that is that political ideology does not matter to the guys on the ground. I found the military to be extremely politically agnostic. I think that's a good thing. And strategy, national policy, those kind of things just simply didn't resonate with people who had their boots in the sand in Iraq.
Evan, do you? Nathaniel is obviously an exceptionally bright man, and came out of Dartmouth. The guys who came out of the hood, who you were rumbling around with, would they have the same point of view?
Well, by the way, you know, these are great guys to write about from Fick on down. I mean, they sort of had all had different takes on it. And he's right; they did not sit around. They did debate politics, but they also know at the end of the day it doesn't matter to them. I think, and I was also in Afghanistan too, and there was a difference. But I think in Iraq, they were more motivated in terms of liberating the country. And in the early weeks, it did really seem, I mean, as a cynic, I did see in lots of towns people coming out and cheering the Americans. And of course, they questioned whether they were just doing that as some sort of show to appease them and not have their towns bombed. But it seemed genuine at the time. But what happened very quickly, and what I go into in the book, and I sort of describe he was a lieutenant then, his evolution is very quickly in Baghdad, it became clear that we could not provide security to the Iraqis. And they, you know, they were suffering because at night the city was just, you know, turned into one big firefight. Because the Americans wouldn't leave their bases and go in and try to protect people. So I think there was a feeling that we started losing the war very quickly after the fall of Baghdad.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. You get me right to the point there, Evan, with that last comment. Both of you have earned the right to comment on the situation in Iraq today. And Nathaniel, when you think of what your guys went through, what you went through, leading them to Baghdad, the mistakes that were made along the way, fatal mistakes, that passage of the young girl being killed is horrifying. When you look back, what do you feel about this last year? The occupation pretty clearly has not been a success.
Well, it's not over yet, and my guys are still there. They returned to Fallujah earlier this year. And so I read the newspaper every day with fear and trepidation.
Do you feel resentment? Now that you're out of the military, you can speak freely. Do you feel resentment?
I did. It was a tough readjustment process. I think that the war itself went well, and things now are a mess. And I don't know what the answer is, but I don't like it when people are quick to jump to sort of half-baked conclusions based on, you know, only what they've read.
Now, Evan, I mean, you traveled with these guys. Have you stayed in touch with some of them?
Yeah, I'm in touch with them. I should point out that Lieutenant Fick's replacement in 2nd Platoon, Captain Brent Morrell, died outside Fallujah on April 7th, I believe, this year, who was shot in a firefight. And the vehicle that I rode in during the course of the book was destroyed. But I think very quickly, I think Lieutenant Fick is right. The war, it's not over yet. And there was a sense of what a disaster, you know, in the first weeks of the occupation as Baghdad burned. But the one thing that I took away from this experience is I'm much more of an agnostic about, I'm much less willing to make, you know, grand predictions about the future. I do believe that if you look at it strategically, whether we like it or not, we're going to have troops somewhere in the Middle East for a long time. I don't think the handover, I don't think you're going to see us leaving, you know, anytime soon. So we're there and we have to deal with it as a nation.
You can't really know, listeners, unless you were there. That's what Evan Wright says. We can't all be there, and that's probably lucky. But you can read his book, Generation Kill. It's a rough read, I'll tell you. It's a very honest read. I'm amazed the military let you get this one out, Evan. I mean,
they are, too.
Yeah, they'll be reconsidering that proposition. And whoever gave you permission is cleaning latrines for the rest of his career. Thank you very much for joining us, Evan Wright. Thank you, Nathaniel Fick. Good luck. You're going to be at the Kennedy School here in Boston, I'm told, next autumn. Maybe you'll come by The Connection again.
I'd love to. Thanks.
Okay. Evan Wright's book is called Generation Kill, Devil Dogs, Iceman, Captain America, and the New Face of American War. The Connection is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugerts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.